Good evening and welcome to another Legal Ethics session. I am Mordechai Torchiner with Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion, Beit Midrash, Zichron Tov. I'm grateful to Shari Shamayim for partnering on this program. I'll also note I'm grateful to Jeffrey Silver for his help in finding cases and materials to help me prepare for this session. Please do make sure that you sign in on the sign-in sheets, particularly if you want credit, but also if you want notification about future sessions or the follow-up from this one. As often happens, there are questions that come up that I'm not able to answer on the spot, but I'll be able to follow up with afterwards. This is the last of the pre-summer legal ethics sessions that I'm doing as standalone sessions. There is a program coming up, as I mentioned in the email advertising this one. There's a program coming up on May 23rd, Tuesday, May 23rd in the morning, and that will be here. It's being run by B'nai B'rith. It has credit for lawyers as well as accountants. The issues are powers of attorney and challenges related to them. That's on May 23rd. I will also note, as I did in the email, that I'm very glad to be able to offer these sessions free of charge. However, the Beit Midrash that I represent is funded entirely by local donations. So we are having a dinner on June 15th. If people are able to support that, great. I will be following up with an email afterwards that will include the details for how one might do that. Okay, private life, public penalty disqualification for public misconduct. So there's a lot to talk about within this topic. The question of whether, but how and why a lawyer could lose his or her license, or paralegal for that matter, or could be blocked from obtaining a license due to a history of personal misconduct. I wanted to begin with a case that's actually not a Canadian case. It's an American case, because I came across it in developing this, and I found it to be a fascinating one, and I've been told that Canadians and Americans would actually view this differently. So I am especially curious. It's source number one on your sheets, involving a lawyer by the name of Robert Snyder. In March 1983, petitioner Robert Snyder was appointed by the Federal District Court for the District of North Dakota to represent a defendant under the Criminal Justice Act. After petitioner completed the assignment, he submitted a claim for $1,898 for services and expenses. The claim was reduced by the district court to $1,796. Okay. Under the Criminal Justice Act, the chief judge of the Court of Appeals was required to review and approve expenditures for compensation in excess of $1,000. Chief Judge Lay found the claim insufficiently documented, returned it with a request for additional information. The lawyer has technical problems with his computer software. He can't readily provide the information in the form requested by the chief judge. He did, however, file a supplemental application. Secretary of the chief judge of the circuit again returns the application, stating that the preferred documentation was unacceptable. So here he is, you know, haggling back and forth for the $1,700 that he has in expenses. He's gone through a couple of go-rounds. Petitioner then discusses the matter with Helen Monteith, the district court judge's secretary, who suggests he write a letter expressing his view. Petitioner then wrote the letter that led to this case. The letter addressed to Ms. Monteith read in part, quote, "In the first place, I am appalled by the amount of money which the federal court pays for indigent criminal defense work. The reason that so few attorneys in Bismarck accept this work is for that exact reason. We have, up to this point, still accepted the indigent appointments because of a duty to our profession and the fact that nobody else will do it. Now, however, not only are we paid an amount of money which does not even cover our overhead, but we have to go through extreme gymnastics even to receive the puny amounts which the federal courts authorize for this work. We have sent you everything we have concerning our representation. I am not sending you anything else. You can take it or leave it. Further, I am extremely disgusted by the treatment of us by the Eighth Circuit in this case, and you are instructed to remove my name from the list of attorneys who will accept criminal indigent defense work. I have simply had it. Thank you for your time and attention." Okay. So he lost his license for a six-month period over this. He was suspended for a six-month period. Before we get to the conclusion of the Supreme Court's decision on this, agree or disagree with the suspension? Disagrees. We have a lot of disagreements. Why? Well, first, does anyone agree? No one agrees. Okay, so let's move on to disagreement. Why disagree?
He was right.
He was right, meaning?
Said I'm more gentle.
Okay, he was right. He should have said it more gently, but he was right. He wants to get paid. He's gone through several runarounds on this.
There's nothing unethical about his conduct. It's a little harsh, but not unethical.
Isn't that anything that's reputable? What's he done? He's just...
So I feel good now, because I had that same reaction, and I was told it's because I'm an American, and therefore I find this normal. You still hold by that, and you will admit to it in public. Okay. Michael, careful. Gwendolyn, sorry?
I'm going to take the other side.
Yeah.
This is disrespect for the courts, and I don't have a problem with suspension on this issue.
Okay.
You talk like this in open court, so it's inappropriate to write it.
Right. I can imagine this in an email. You know, somebody who didn't realize the way things come across.
He's not attacking the integrity of the court. He's basically complaining. Can you make me jump to all these hoops?
Right.
What do you want from me? And I'm not taking any more cases. Take my name off.
Right. Yes.
I just need to read that paper in his position there. Because if the issue is that he couldn't get through the information because of technical difficulty, but yet provided the information in a certain form, but still rejecting it, for no other reason other than that it's not informed, because you don't have those details.
Right.
I would say that sort of nonsense, where literally some of the time is just being wasted.
Right.
And I think he's a duty to advocate for that position.
Right.
I don't think this is the proper form.
Right. The question really isn't, is he wrong for protesting? The question is he wrong for how he protested? You know, that's really where he gets into trouble. Let's look at what the Supreme Court does with this. The last paragraph in number one. All persons involved in the judicial process, judges, litigants, witnesses, and court officers, owe a duty of courtesy to all other participants. The necessity for civility in the inherently contentious setting of the adversary process suggests that members of the bar cast criticisms of the system in a professional and civil tone. However, even assuming that the letter exhibited an unlawyer-like rudeness, a single incident of rudeness or lack of professional courtesy in this context does not support a finding of contemptuous or contumacious conduct, or a finding that a lawyer is, quote, not presently fit to practice law in the federal courts. Nor does it rise to the level of conduct unbecoming a member of the bar, warranting suspension from practice. Accordingly, the judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the Supreme Court says he gets to go back to work. I found this to be fascinating. First question that I would have to ask, and that's going to feed into our discussion, is the question of whether this conduct that we're talking about, or misconduct, is personal or professional. Would you call this personal misconduct or professional misconduct? Professional misconduct. Why?
It's in the context of his...
Right. It took place in the context of managing his practice, and it's disrespectful interaction with the institutions of the legal system. It's not he was disrespectful to his neighbor, it's he was disrespectful to the legal system. So you could argue that. On the other hand, I think you could argue that it's personal, in the sense that it displays what we're going to call poor character, which, if displayed in public, could undermine faith in the legal system. It's not so much that he shows he's a bad lawyer as that he shows that he is a person with a temper, you know, with a problem controlling his temper. This question is going to matter. I'm not just asking the question out of curiosity. The question is going to matter. Hang on. In terms of how we qualify different types of misconduct and the rules that govern each kind. Read.
You have to look no further than he defended a person in the bill with $1,780 to know there isn't any more questions that you have. He defended the person in the case and his bill was $1,780. Unless you're contesting he didn't come to court, he wasn't there, and he didn't show up, he spent $1,780. So the court is the one showing contempt for the process and for his
right.
He's just saying, no more acting contemptible.
So I'm not really going to litigate the case of Snyder, because this was 25 years ago, and he doesn't really need it. But I'm going to leave out that question, because I'm more curious about the way we're going to view this in the context of claims of misconduct. Yeah.
Many years ago, people would apply for subsidies to send their kids to boarding schools. That process was a pandemic for the parents, because the people on the board would interrogate them at every expense. Why did you go on a trip? It was humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
But they went through it. But every side still knew there was only so much money that the school board had that they could allocate for kids to boarding.
Okay.
And I think there is an element of stability that it's not personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's only so much money to go around.
Right.
And, you know, I happen to think that this lawyer here is losing sight of that. That the guy on the other side is not going to get rich for the $100. But he has to protect the system so that there's enough money to go around. So they have rules and say you've got to prove it because there isn't enough money to go around. It's not that this guy's trying to bleed this guy to death.
No,
I do think that this guy, by lashing out like this,
is
wrong because this other guy is not being paid a fortune to go after his $100.
Right.
I hear you. I do think that he has lost his own sense of what this process was supposed to be about.
Could be.
With just not enough money go around.
Understood. I'm going to move on, though, from the question of whether he's right or wrong, because there's so much more to this. The one question is gradation of personal versus professional misconduct. The second question is the question we've already discussed. If it is personal misconduct, does it rise to the level of suspension from practice? And then a third question. The court seeks an apology from him. He declines to apologize. They tell him, apologize and you won't be suspended. He says, I'm not apologizing. Theoretically, though, had he apologized, would apology and remorse be sufficient to atone for an act of personal misconduct? That's the third question that I have here. So we're going to be framing our discussion in terms of these three points. In terms of professional versus personal misconduct, in terms of the question of what level of personal misconduct warrants action, and then third, the question of how one is readmitted. And all through it, we're going to compare and contrast the system that exists in Ontario under the Law Society and the system that would exist in parallel within halacha, within Jewish law. So those are our three basic questions. I brought you here number two, the two Law Society direct rules of professional conduct that we need to see. There is much more that we're going to come across in the course of the next of the rest of the session. But in number two, Rule 7.8.2-2, the Law Society may discipline a lawyer for professional misconduct. That's number one. And then number two, the Law Society may discipline a lawyer for conduct unbecoming a lawyer. It is within their purview to say, this person may be a fine lawyer, however, he's a horrible human being. He doesn't conduct himself in the way that we want lawyers to conduct themselves. And I'm not talking about Snyder. Please don't take offense on behalf of Snyder. I've never even met him. But the fundamental point is that it's within the rights of the Law Society to say he doesn't act the way a lawyer ought to behave. So we start with three cases that I bring you here on the sheet in sources 3, 4, and 5, just to show you a little bit more about this. First, professional incompetence and what it's about. I give you the case of Hutton as referenced in an appeal when he wanted to come back to practice in number 3. Hutton was called to the bar of Nova Scotia on August 9, 1985. He practiced until June 5, 1987 when he was suspended from practice, and his practice was placed under custodianship. He was adjudged bankrupt in July 1987, discharged from bankruptcy in 1988. The first decision of the Nova Scotia Barrister Society, dated June 5, 1987, dealt with complaints involving Hutton's failure to forward money and documents to clients. The discipline committee noted that the missing items reached the clients just prior to the hearing, and the committee commented that the calling of a formal hearing appeared necessary to cause the solicitor to react. The following comments were made with respect to Hutton's competence. These were all real estate transactions, and the evidence gave us the distinct impression that the solicitor was not at all competent to act in this field. In the opinion of this committee, the solicitor's attitude toward his client's affairs is such that his competence to practice law in any field is in question. If his failure to answer correspondence is an indication of the level of his professionalism, and if his manner in handling the transactions of these clients is an indication of his competence, it would be in the public interest if the solicitor be removed from the practice of law at least until such time as he is able to satisfy the Society's Qualifications Committee that his habits, attitudes, and practices have improved to the point where he should regain his privileges. That's basic professional incompetence. Somebody who doesn't do his work at the time necessary on behalf of the client is considered to be professionally incompetent and can lose his ability to practice, lose the power to practice on that basis. That's part one. That's relatively straightforward. Part two is personal misconduct, which has a different problem. Personal misconduct, as we're going to see, is not necessarily about saying this person doesn't know how to do his job, but rather this person is going to cause mistrust in the legal system. Take a look at source number four. This is from a case for which the lawyer involved is not named, just identified as S.A.T. If you happen to know who it is, don't say. Andrew Oliver is speaking on behalf of the panel. On December 4th, 2012, the applicant S.A.T. applied to the Law Society for a Class P1 license. In his application, the applicant disclosed a relatively significant criminal record, albeit for mostly minor offenses. Most of those offenses involved alcohol. After he submitted his application in late 2012, the applicant had two further encounters with the criminal justice system. These resulted in convictions for uttering death threats and failing to stop when signaled by a police officer. The applicant will be on probation until December 2014. The issue in this hearing is whether the applicant is currently of good character, and for the reasons that follow, we find he is not, etc. So here you're talking about somebody for whom we have no idea how he is as a lawyer. We don't even know what kind of law he practices, or whether it's he or she. I also am not aware. Actually, did it give a gender? He. Right. We find he is not. Okay. But what's germane here is poor character, as opposed to anything that demonstrates that SAT cannot conduct a legal practice. But that's your second type of disqualification. And then third, under the issue of readmission, I bring you number five. This is a horribly tragic case. Sarah Jackson, the lawyer, admits through an agreed statement of facts that she committed professional misconduct when she did not report various criminal charges to the Law Society in 2012 and 2013. In other words, if you're going to practice law, you have to report any criminal charges against you to the Law Society. She didn't do it. She also admits that she engaged in conduct unbecoming a lawyer in January 2013 when she facilitated the acquisition and use of heroin by somebody who's identified as EC, who died of an overdose on the night she assisted him in getting drugs. Ms. Jackson, who was in her late 30s and was called to the bar in 2003, has not had an active license to practice law since January 2013. She's been suspended. She hasn't been practicing. I'm jumping to the third paragraph there. The parties made a joint submission for a penalty of a suspension of 8 months retroactively commencing in May 2016. The proposed order also contained terms that she not return to practice until a medical practitioner confirmed her ability to meet her obligations as a lawyer and that she pay costs of $1,000. We accepted the joint submission as reasonable and made the requested order with reasons to follow. In other words, they accept her back. This is somebody who had criminal charges against her that she did not report. This is somebody who gave a fellow heroin which killed him. And in the actual piece, if you were to look this up, you would find all the gory details about this. It was pretty ugly. And has been suspended. But after the suspension, and after a medical practitioner says that she, she can meet her obligations as a lawyer, now she's able to come back. So the third bit of this is going to be the discussion of what do we require in order for her to be able to return. For anybody who came in late, there are source sheets here on the table still. Please do make sure that you sign in, because without it, I will not be able to give you credit, and without it, you won't get notification of future programs. Okay, so with this all as introduction, let's move to the meat of the issue. First of all, there is disqualification due to professional incompetence or misconduct. I brought you source number six from the Law Society Act. A licensee shall not engage in professional misconduct or conduct unbecoming a licensee. And if you take a look at source number 7, excuse me, if you take a look at source number 7, you find an expansion of this. A lawyer has a duty, in the Law Society's own rules, a lawyer has a duty to carry on the practice of law and discharge all responsibilities to clients, tribunals, the public, and other members of the profession honorably and with integrity. And in the commentary, public confidence in the administration of justice and in the legal profession may be eroded by a lawyer's irresponsible conduct. Accordingly, a lawyer's conduct should reflect favorably on the legal profession, inspire the confidence, respect, and trust of clients and of the community, and avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And I brought you an actual case of Robert Charles Watt in source number 8. I'm not going to read it aloud, but you have it there for a practical case of incompetence leading to suspension of a license. So that's a lawyer who actively harms the client, like who does something bad. The case of Watt is a case in which money he's responsible for mysteriously makes it into his own bank account. So that's not an issue of incompetence, that's an issue of being very competent at something other than the practice of law. The other type is the lawyer who, in fact, is not competent in his legal work. We saw that in the Hutton case, and I brought you the Law Society Act in source number 9, where they speak of a lawyer not meeting the standards of professional competence. There are deficiencies in knowledge, skill, or judgment, attention to the interests of clients, the record systems and procedures, and so on. That's what we talk about when we speak of professional incompetence or misconduct. So now let's go back to our initial question and the case of Snyder, right? The fellow who's angry because he's getting the runaround on reimbursal for the expenses he incurred in defending an indigent client. Does Snyder's conduct, writing a rude letter, meet the definition of professional misconduct, based on what you're seeing here, in terms of either harming a client or in terms of displaying professional incompetence? Does Snyder meet that? I think not. And the reason I stress this is because what it shows is that the definition of professional misconduct is not misconduct which takes place while carrying out one's practice. Rather, professional misconduct means either you harmed the client, who is part of your profession, is part of your practice, you harmed the client, or you didn't properly represent the client. But doing something that displays bad character in the course of running your practice, but doesn't either display, harming the client and doesn't display inadequate representation, isn't professional incompetence. That's not the case, and the distinction is going to matter. But that's the basics of professional misconduct within the secular system. Now I want to shift over to halacha, to Jewish law. So whenever you make the analogy from the way the secular system handles lawyers and the way that the Jewish system handles its courts, you have to acknowledge right off the bat that there are no formal lawyers within the Jewish legal system. We've discussed this before in other sessions. While it is true that going all the way back to Talmudic times 2,000 years ago, you had what were called Orchei HaDayanim, which is in fact a modern term for a lawyer in Hebrew, Orech Din, and they would indeed present the position of the litigants before the Beit Din, before the rabbinical court, there was no formal legal function of being a lawyer. So you can't make an analogy and say, well, there's professional misconduct for a lawyer in the secular system, and there's professional misconduct for a lawyer in the Jewish system. That won't fly. However, there are other professionals within the Jewish legal system, and those are the judges. And there is a concept of disqualifying a rabbinic judge from a Beit Din, from a court of law, for misconduct. So that's where I want to draw the analogy, is from lawyer in the secular system to judge within the Jewish system. So first of all, ordination. In order for a judge to be qualified to serve, the judge has to be ordained. As a matter of fact, what we call rabbinic ordination today isn't really ordination. The original ordination was to serve on what you could think of as a bench. In other words, there are particular locations and each location, each municipality has a need for judges who are going to hear cases, whether you're talking about financial litigation or whether you're talking about a rabbi answering legal questions. And when there's a vacancy on it, that's when ordination takes place. Ordination is not based on passing a test. It isn't that you passed an exam and now you can be ordained. Rather, it's based on the need of the community, and it's based on the lawyer having not only demonstrated, the lawyer, based on the rabbi, based on the judge, not only demonstrating knowledge of the material, but also having done some kind of apprenticeship. What's called in Hebrew, shimush. So what happens if somebody is ordained, and it turns out that the ordination was done inappropriately, by mistake? He didn't have adequate training in order to receive ordination. So this person is not competent. And if you take a look at source number 10, you find the law is framed by Rabbi Moses Maimonides in the 12th century. In general, I'm going to bring you a lot from Maimonides, not because he's the first one to state the law. In this case, for example, it comes to this law that he's stating is based on a passage in the Talmud in a volume called Sanhedrin on page 7. However, Maimonides tends to state things succinctly in a code of law, and that's very useful for a source sheet. So if you take a look at source number 10, he writes, someone who's unfit to judge, because he doesn't know the material, or because he is unfit in terms of his conduct. And yet, he received ordination anyway, and he continues to explain. In the interest of time, I'm going to read out to the English, but you can see the Hebrew as well for those who are able to read it. In the event that he was ordained anyway, the exilarch, leader of the Jewish community outside of the land of Israel, inappropriately licensed him, or the court that licensed him did so by mistake. He says it's ineffective. He's no good. He says it's like dedicating an animal for an offering in the temple. If it's not eligible, it's not eligible. So number one, you can't be ordained in the event that you don't know what you're doing and don't have the character. But let's say somebody was properly ordained, and then he displays incompetence. So the Talmud brings a story which is vague. Take a look at source number 11. There's one word in it that's the key word. A judge gave a creditor access to a borrower's assets before the claim against the borrower had been filed. In other words, I lend somebody money. Time comes when I say he owes me the money. The procedure is I go to court and say he hasn't paid me, and the court has to figure out whether to descend into his assets or not. However, this judge didn't do that. The case was not heard. He simply said to the creditor, looks like a good document. Go ahead. Well, that's clearly inappropriate. What happened? Rav Chanan, the son of Rav Yeva, removed him. So here's the big question. Source number 11, who got removed? And from what? Who was removed and from what in source number 11? Sorry? The judge was removed. So that's certainly one way to read it. How else could you read it? The creditor got removed from the property, right? You could legitimately read that either way. The same verb would be used for removing the judge from the bench and removing the creditor from the assets. So source number 12 is one example of an early authority who said that, no, it means the judge was removed. Rav Chanan removed him because he thought that just as the judge had erred in this, so he would err in other cases. So this may be seen as precedent for the idea of removal of a judge for professional incompetence. However, others disagreed and said, no, that's not what the Talmud means here. And they argued, how in the world could you remove a judge for making one mistake? So if you take a look at source number 13, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach Duran said, we have not seen that a judge who errs in judgment is disqualified to judge other cases, even where he must pay restitution personally. In other words, even if it's bad enough that he's going to have to pay for his mistake, you don't remove him. Everyone makes mistakes. Even the great sages of the Mishnah, the founding text of the Talmud, made mistakes. So how can you tell me that you're going to remove him? Yeah.
I'm not a litigant, but I have a question about that.
Yes.
Why does the Talmud think that judgment is a mistake when the law of the carrier was helping, that if you could prove that you had a claim, or you could have a claim, and somebody was ready to defraud you of that asset, there is a procedure in Ontario where you could file a lien against property before you even claim it.
Precisely. Number one, you're right. But number one, you have to go through the cycle of proof, which requires convening of a court, which didn't happen here. Number two, you have to have a...
Wasn't this a court of Jewish courts?
This was a lone judge. You need three judges for a rabbinical court. The judge looked at the document, said, looks good, go ahead. That's what, this was not... He didn't go through the proper procedure. Number two, it's if someone's going to defraud you. There are provisions in Jewish law to act in the event that you stand to take a loss if you don't act right now, the equivalent of the injunction, you know, type of a thing. But that's not necessarily the case here. And number three, it's not a lien. He actually went into property. He took assets. Yes?
I presume, though, that the based in or the judges hear all types of cases.
Yes.
They have expertise in one area and not in the other area.
So his...
This one may have a judge knowledgeable in family law, but not in creditor's rights. So if he gets a case in creditor's rights, they throw him off the bench just because he's incompetent in creditor's rights.
Right. So in this era, you don't have that kind of specialization in standard ordination. There were. You could have it. Let me restate it. The Talmud describes specific types of ordination, so you could be ordained for a particular field. However, it sounds like this judge had a generic approval, what's called yadin, that he's able to judge cases of choshen mishpat, of business law in general, financial interactions, without applying it to a specific type of litigation. So, generally speaking, you have a debate. Would we remove somebody for incompetence? The one exception, which is a fascinating one, Maimonides discusses it in source number 14, is if somebody is a public employee. In the event that you are a public employee, as Maimonides writes there, he's based on a passage in the Talmud, then you are considered forewarned that everything you do has to be right, because you're acting in the service of the public. And yes, he could actually be removed in that regard. What everybody agrees on, though, whether you're talking about the view that says that in number 11 he was removed from the bench or not, everyone will agree, including Rabbi Duran from number 13, that if the judge exhibits a pattern of carelessness, then the judge is indeed removed. So if you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Duran himself wrote, but if this judge errs, not because of the great wisdom required in order to get things right, but because he's careless with his learning, leading to intentional harm, we view it as though it's intentional, and many of his decisions are in error, one could disqualify him. Then you could disqualify somebody. So professional misconduct exists within the law society's purview, in terms of a lawyer who harms the client, or in terms of a lawyer who serves the client in a way that is incompetent, and it exists in Jewish law in terms of the judge potentially being removed in the event that the judge demonstrates a pattern of carelessness. I did see one view who argued it's just the bad luck of the litigant, who got hurt by the judge in this case, but we generally assume that that's not so. But you have a system of quality control regarding professional conduct and misconduct. Yes, Jeffrey.
Why do you focus the passes on the lawyer? You have that with judges.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. No, that's absolutely true. Okay. However, when it comes to personal misconduct, both the law society and Jewish law are reluctant to get involved. They don't like getting involved. And there are various reasons for it, which I summed up on your sheet, rather than go through everything at length. But take a look first at number 16. Commentary to Rule 2.1-1 in the Law Society's rules. 2.1-1 is the one that says that they're able to remove somebody for professional or personal misconduct. But number 16, the commentary says, dishonorable or questionable conduct on the part of a lawyer in either private life or professional practice will reflect adversely upon the integrity of the profession and the administration of justice. I'm going to come back to that. Whether within or outside the professional sphere, if the conduct is such that knowledge of it would be likely to impair a client's trust in the lawyer, the law society may be justified in taking disciplinary action. But then they say, generally, however, the law society will not be concerned with the purely private or extra-professional activities of a lawyer that do not bring into question the lawyer's professional integrity. The law society would prefer not to get involved in what you're doing personally. They don't want to go there. As we'll see, the same thing is true within Jewish law. Within the secular system, though, why doesn't the law society want to get involved with personal misconduct if they can avoid it? I can think of a few reasons. Don't look at the ones I listed on the sheet. What do you think? Why would they? Yeah. Right. So part of it is that it's just a pain. The panel may be guilty also. I didn't think about that one. I have a different view of lawyers because I'm married to one. The fact of the matter is that it's a very vague standard. It's hard to enforce, and it's going to eat up the time of people who have other things to do. And that's one reason why they'll stay away from it. It's a big burden. Why else?
You get into what's morally just, the line may be.
Right, well, that's the ambiguity issue and the challenge of enforcement. There's also the matter of the basic idea that people have a right to practice a profession. And there's a high standard for taking away the person's ability to practice. It's not as simple as saying, I think that this person is going to give the law a bad reputation. I think that's a second factor. A third factor is there's a right to privacy. And this is something we discussed a couple of years ago when we had a session on confidentiality. But everything from the Section 8 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to the Privacy Act to all sorts of other things, there's a tort now, intrusion upon seclusion, says that you are able to claim privacy for your conduct. We don't want to start invading what this person is doing outside of his or her professional involvement. And then last, we want more lawyers. There's an issue of access to justice. In the event, and maybe this goes back to the problem of the panel being populated by people who may find the finger pointed at them, but if you're going to start disqualifying people because we don't like the fact that they write rude letters, to go back to the Snyder case, we may have a problem in that people will not be able to obtain proper representation because we've knocked a whole bunch of lawyers off of the board. Well, Jewish law also prefers not to pursue this, but for different reasons. First of all, within Jewish law, there is no such thing as the right to pursue a profession, and certainly not when it comes to the law. In general, Judaism is responsibilities-based as opposed to rights-based. Whereas the secular Western system is built on, I have the right to do this, this, and this, in Judaism it's much more about, you have a responsibility to do a whole bunch of things. But in particular, when it comes to law, if you take a look at source number 19, I brought you one key source on this from the Talmud. They quote a verse in Proverbs, which says, for it has cast down many corpses. And it, in the context of this verse, is understood to mean the Torah. The Torah has cast down many corpses. What does that mean? This refers to a Torah scholar who is unworthy of ruling, and yet he rules. Meaning, he's not somebody who's ready, but he insists anyway that he is going to decide cases. And then the second part of the same verse, which says, and she has killed many, that's also a reference to Torah, the she, and it refers to a Torah scholar who is worthy of ruling and does not do so. Meaning, if the scholar could rule, could resolve cases, could answer questions, and refrains, then that person is also guilty. In other words, practicing law, or in this case, serving as a judge, is not up to your personal discretion. Either you're not worthy, in which case you have no business getting involved with it, or you are worthy, in which case you don't have the right to walk away. There's no issue of right to practice. It's responsibility to practice or responsibility not to practice. So that's not really an issue here.
Is that ability-based, or is that a possibility where, let's say, there'd be a conflict of interest, and therefore, like we're talking about knowledge?
Right, so it seems to be, right.
The judge has the knowledge necessary to rule.
Right.
Versus, in a particular case, there may be a conflict of interest.
Right. So, in context, this statement is about ability. In the Hebrew here is higia lahora'ah, has reached the level of ruling. However, a judge with a conflict of interest would be required to recuse. We had a session on conflict of interest a while back. There's no question that conflict of interest is a bar to participation. But it's not what this passage is talking about here. It's talking about, is this judge properly trained and able to practice? There are other factors. The right to privacy is very strong within Judaism. We've discussed this before, the issue of the privacy of individuals, the importance of privacy for the sake of society as a whole is very significant. The access to justice we've also talked about in other sessions is also something that's very important within Judaism. We want there to be judges around in this case rather than lawyers, but that's very important. The fact that this is a broad and vague standard to enforce, this issue of personal misconduct, probably would not stop Judaism from applying it. We have many rules and standards that are broad and difficult to enforce, and that's just the way the system works. It's more comfortable with that which is ambiguous than the secular system is. But there's a very interesting added factor. Yes?
I would thought that when it comes to a Jewish judge, the privacy issue is really, there is no such issue like that. Because if you have, say, a judge who's not, following the commandments, and he's striving on a Sabbath, shouldn't that disqualify him from
judgment? So we're going to get to that question. Right now what I'm showing is the default position. And the default position is we'd rather not get involved. But we'll see that there are cases where, indeed, you will, just like in the secular system, we'd rather not get involved, but there will be cases where we will anyway. I'm just trying to show that the default is we'd rather not get involved. That would be the initial preference. There's an added factor in the Jewish system that you don't find in the secular one, and that's what I brought you here in source number 20. It's the honor of the sage involved, and really the honor of the Torah that the sage represents. And this is a major difference. Meaning, when you deal with the secular system, The understanding is that in the event that somebody engages in misconduct, so you take them out and that's it. And the law doesn't suffer. If anything, the law is honored by the fact that you upheld a standard. Within Judaism, there is a level of discomfort with the idea that this person was so learned and so steeped in it and yet went bad. So take a look at source number 20, which is a very important source. We're going to have to come back to it later for additional discussion. Passage out of the Talmud. Rav Huna wrote, Rav Huna is a sage from, I believe, 5th century. He says, there was an enactment made in the city of Usha. The city of Usha was the home of the central body of Jewish sages at the end of the 1st century, beginning of the 2nd century Common Era. He says, they made a rule. If a chief justice, an Av Beit Din, if a chief justice goes bad, and goes bad means sort of what you were talking about before, we're hearing about misconduct. Not professional misconduct, personal misconduct. We do not excommunicate him. There will not be a formal declaration of this person has been banned for bad practice. We tell him, be honored and remain at home. In other words, don't come to work. We are suspending you, but we'd rather not have to make a big stink about it and put it in the newspapers. However, if he repeats the act, if he does it again, we excommunicate him because of desecration of God's name. Meaning at a certain point, you have to just say, it's all well and good that we want to protect the honor of the law, but you're not protecting the honor of the law if this person is going to be a repeat offender. Everyone's going to know what's going on. He's not backing down. He's not refraining from his misconduct. At this point, let the chips fall where they may. You have to make a public declaration of his misconduct. The rabbinical court that's faced with this fund. So we don't generally have a court of appeal. He's out of luck. When he gets... Sorry? He's still being removed from his position. The only question is, are you going to make it publicly known? That's really the issue. Jeffrey?
Well, in that senator, the design, or the law society, is in fact, is telling the lawyer after one of his
Right, but I think it's for a different reason, no? In other words, here, the reason is because of the honor of the Torah this person represents, whereas in the legal system, I think it's because we want to avoid the whole knockdown, drag out thing and the expense and all of that, and we tell him just, you know, go home. Okay. Yes.
Just as an aside, the honor of the crown does come into certain principles.
Yeah. In terms of person, right? But in terms of misconduct of a lawyer?
No, not misconduct. Well, the honor of the crown, I think, is just a principle that you uphold in some of the work you do. So,
right.
If you're representing the government and you're negotiating with a party, you have to think about the honor of the crown.
Right.
In terms of how you do that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that goes back to the point about personal misconduct in general and what it says about the integrity of the system. Absolutely agreed. Yeah.
Practically, who represents the Chief Justice?
So,
the Chief Justice is the head of the court.
So, right. So this has to be litigated in a different Beit Din, in a different court. In other words, they're going to convene a separate court responsible to hear the evidence and make a decision.
Who's they?
They will be the other judges on this court, or if the misconduct occurred in a different municipality, the court from that municipality.
And they have jurisdiction over.
Correct. Yeah. This is not just like abstract. This is something that's actually happened and been dealt with. Rabbi Moshe Sofer in the 18th century, in source number 21, dealt with such an issue in which there was somebody who had made certain mistakes. It was a judge who had made certain mistakes, and he felt here because the mistakes did not impact on others, best to just say to him, "Be honored and remain at home." He quoted this idea that we see in number 20. So both systems, what we've seen so far, both systems will punish professional misconduct. That's number one. We've seen that professional misconduct means either incompetence in carrying out one's duties or harming the client in the case of a lawyer who has a client in the Jewish side of it. It's talking about a judge. And we've also seen that there's a reticence to punish somebody for personal misconduct, although each system has its own reasons for doing so. Despite that, as has already been noted, both systems will punish personal misconduct. Both systems have rules to that effect. The big question is, so how do you define personal misconduct? So one of the standards that gets quoted in many cases, yeah?
Sorry, I have a question. Going back for a second.
Yes.
So I guess my question is, I understand the notion of this person's knowledge or a person represents the degree. So to make a public pronunciation has a negative association with Torah, but like when you're talking about an obvious, like is it really going to be a secret? Like are we not worried that like rumors are going to start happening and that really brings Torah into like greater disrepute? Very
right. So I think to a certain extent it's dependent on the society, and a society with telecommunications and a society with an internet, things travel differently. Having said that, they have the discretion to be able to say it's gone too far. You know, to say this is already public and therefore we need to act. I think this is just the default. So the standard that gets quoted in various cases is the one I bring you in source number 22. From Mary, I don't know if that's pronounced Southern or Southern, do you know?
Southern.
Southern? Thank you. She's now a judge. At the time she was not. But she says, good character means those qualities which might reasonably be considered in the eyes of reasonable men and women to be relevant to the practice of law in British Columbia at the time of application. Character within the act comprises, in my opinion, at least these qualities. An appreciation of the difference between right and wrong. The moral fiber to do that which is right, no matter how uncomfortable the doing may be, and not to do that which is wrong, no matter what the consequences may be to oneself. So, knowing right and wrong, the guts to do what's right and not to do what's wrong, a belief that the law, at least so far as it forbids things which are malum in se, I added in a little translation there, inherently wrong, must be upheld, and the courage to see that it is upheld. She views character as being your relationship with right and wrong. That's the way that she frames it. Will you do the right thing? Will you refrain from doing the wrong thing, despite personal cost? The Law Society, there are other standards that are around, but the Law Society says on this basis, if you take a look at source number 23, conduct unbecoming a barrister or solicitor means conduct, including conduct in a lawyer's personal or private capacity, that tends to bring discredit upon the legal profession. And there you go back to the honor of the crown. It's not specific to the crown, legal profession here. Including, for example, A, committing a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. B, taking improper advantage of the youth, inexperience, lack of education, unsophistication, ill health, or unbusinesslike habits of another. Or C, engaging in conduct involving dishonesty or conduct which undermines the administration of justice. That's what we're talking about. From the Law Society's perspective, and we already discussed this above a little bit back in source number 16, the lawyer is going to be held to a standard of conduct which says, I know right from wrong, I'm willing to act on that basis, and I am not undermining faith in the administration of justice. That's what we're talking about here. Frankly, I'm not entirely sure about applying this to the Snyder case that we talked about in source number one. I don't know if being rude to the court qualifies as undermining the administration of justice or not knowing right from wrong. That's just I'm not really sure about that. Well, according to this, according to Southern, certainly, it's malum in se, right? Until they change the laws, right now, this is considered to be wrong to do, right?
So you're going to get this barred today on July 2nd, when they grant an amnesty to all the previous charges, what do you do with the lawyer then?
From my perspective, if you uphold Southern standard, you can't have an amnesty for the lawyer, no? Because the point wasn't doing acts that we believe are good or bad, but if the law says you can't do it, one would expect the lawyer not to do them. Fair enough. There was a hand here. Yes, Gwendolyn.
That's not malum in se, that's malum prohibitum.
Yeah?
It's not with that which is inherently wrong, that which is prohibited by law. So we fall in that category.
Reading the line here, a belief that the law, at least so far as it forbids things which are malum in se. So you're going to say that this is not necessarily viewed that way today, under the laws today?
It would be malum prohibitum, and the evidence of that is that the law is going to change.
So I guess you'd have to ask the question, which I don't know. How do we define the malum involved? Is it based on when the law was written, or is it based on the date when it's violated?
It's a moral judgment.
Yeah.
She's using this term in a restrictive way.
Yeah.
In other words, to say that if it's something that is simply malum prohibitum,
yeah,
you violated the law, but it's something that, you know, you went 2 miles over the speed limit, you know, that's definitely against the law, but it doesn't, with the term they use, moral turpitude, it doesn't
right.
show moral turpitude.
Right.
And, you know, you can argue, and you have to argue with different things, you would argue different ways. The use of illegal drugs, maybe, you know, maybe you'd say is only non-prohibitive, but it might be a moral judgment.
Right. It's an interesting question.
She said the fact that the school bus when that right. was illegal.
Understood.
Civil rights where it's prohibited, but you have to have the moral courage to stand up to those prohibitions.
It's an interesting point.
So
yeah.
How the Law Society dealt with the Jackson case, where
yes.
the woman, you know, was dealing in heroin, supplying it, and the death of someone, that they suspended her for 8 months. So.
Right, I mean, there's more to that case. In other words, the story was that she had been reunited with an old friend from high school. She wasn't someone who regularly furnished drugs, but she knew where to get them, and he badgered her, and then finally she gave them to him. It wasn't like she didn't sell it to him, and she actually, when you read through the case, accepting the facts as stated, she gave him a dose because he insisted. She checked on his health. Is he okay? Then he wanted a second dose. She checked on his health. Is he okay? Third dose, and she thought everything was fine, and she checks on him, and then wakes up, and he's not fine anymore. Without going into whether they're right or wrong, she wasn't a pusher. That's what I'm trying to say. It shouldn't be portrayed that way. But from a secular perspective, what does emerge here is some sense of the definition of poor character. Judaism also has a definition of poor character. If you take a look at source number, what did I bring here? Number 25. I'm trying to figure out why I brought 24 there. I don't really need it there yet. Okay, we'll come back to it. Number 25. The Talmud speaks of witnesses here. We're now shifting gears in the Jewish system from judges to witnesses. There's a biblical verse, do not set a wicked person as a witness. He would certainly be disqualified as a judge, but as a witness as well. And the Talmud defines what wicked means. Do not set a person of Hamas as a witness. Hamas, as a biblical term, refers to somebody who takes the property of others, generally by force. That's the definition of Hamas as a biblical term. So if you have somebody who engages in taking the property of others, that person is disqualified automatically as a witness. These are, as the Talmud gives examples, bandits, people who break oaths. It is expanded beyond that. It isn't only this category. That's the passage that I brought you here. But it's expanded to include, in general, anyone who is guilty of criminal conduct. You mentioned the case before of breaking Jewish law in terms of the laws of Shabbat. That would indeed potentially qualify, depending a little bit on how it's done and why they did it and so forth. But in general, breaking the laws of the Torah will indeed potentially disqualify somebody for serving as a witness, certainly for serving as a judge. But beyond that, in addition to not honoring the law, there is also an element of personal disqualification. And this brings me to source number 26. Tell me, does Judaism like gambling or not like gambling? What would you say? Does not like gambling, despite all the synagogues that have bingo nights and casino nights and everything else, right? Generally speaking, we're not fans of gambling. And here in the Talmud, we find out why. There is a list here of rabbinic disqualifications for witnesses. These are disqualified, says the Mishnah, the founding text of the Talmud going back to the beginning of the 3rd century. Dice players, that's the example for us. Usurers is a separate discussion. Dove flyers may mean dove racers. People who race doves, also its own discussion. And on this, the Talmud expands with where you see it says Gemara. This is the expansion of the Mishnah. What has a dice player done? What's he done wrong? So one view, Rami Bar Chama said it's what's called asmachta, and the transaction is invalid. And what that means is the following. There are two types of gamblers. Winners and losers. No, there are two types of gamblers. There's the gambler who goes into it saying, this is a game of chance. I'm no better than anybody else. I want to see if I get lucky. I'm going to go to the slots. I'm going to put in whatever it is and pull the thing. And, you know, maybe I win, maybe I lose. That's that. Then you have the gambler who believes that he or she is exceptionally skilled and they're good at what they do and therefore they're going to win. Not necessarily on the slots, not necessarily even professionals. We'll talk about professionals in a second. But somebody who says, I'm a good poker player, I think I'm going to win. And for the type of game that they're talking about in the Talmud, the way they would play is you'd ante up your money in the beginning, and then whoever won would take the pot. And the concern of asmachta is not relevant for the rest of our session, but just to explain what they're talking about is that if you're playing against somebody who thinks they're good at this, they don't expect to lose their money. They put the money in the middle, but they never give up their claim on those funds. And therefore, when you take it because you won, that's actually quasi-theft because they didn't expect to lose. They never surrendered the money. That's the first argument. But then the Talmud continues with a second argument, so you don't have to worry about this question about asmachta right now. I can discuss it after for those who want. But Rav Sheshet is the one who's relevant for us. He says it's not asmachta. Forget that concern. He said the concern is that gamblers are not involved in settling the world. Meaning that they make their money off of taking it from somebody else. They don't provide a service. They don't provide a product. They're just taking other people's money, whether it's because they're better than the other person at the game or whether it's because they're lucky. That's the way they make their money. They're not involved, hang on, they're not involved in the growth of the world. Inevitably, when I do this, someone asks me, well, what about stockbrokers? What's the difference between a stockbroker and the gambler here? But that's another session. That's the Talmud's disqualification, as Rav Sheshet says it. We don't want somebody serving as a witness if this person is not involved in settling the world. And then the Talmud says, well, wait a minute. That's only a concern if this is a person who doesn't have another job. Right? In other words, if you're talking about somebody who is gainfully employed all week, and then on Sunday they go gambling, they are involved in settling the world. They just also like to gamble. Whether it's healthy or not, that's its own discussion. But you can't call them unproductive citizens. As opposed to somebody who is a gambler all the time, and that's really where this would be a concern. But this is a matter of personal misconduct. It's not a matter of professional misconduct. So the question now that I want to ask is this: we've seen that by default we don't want to pursue personal misconduct. That's the default. And yet both systems have standards. Whether it's the law society, will you uphold right and wrong in general? Or whether it's the Jewish law, will you uphold Jewish law and will you be involved in building up the world? Both of them have disqualifications for personal misconduct. And the question is why? So the law society's perspective is in source number... Well, the law society's perspective really is what we saw above in terms of conduct unbecoming. I brought you an example of it, though, in the Bolton case in source number 27. It is important that there should be a full understanding of the reasons why the tribunal makes orders which might otherwise seem harsh in this case of punishing a lawyer for misconduct. In most cases, the order of the tribunal will be primarily directed to one or other or both of two other purposes. One is to be sure that the offender does not have the opportunity to repeat the offense. This purpose is achieved for a limited period by an order of suspension. Plainly, it is hoped that the experience of suspension will make the offender meticulous in his future compliance with the required standards. So one reason why the law society will get involved is to deter bad behavior in the future. But the second one is the more important one. The second purpose is the most fundamental of all: to maintain the reputation of the solicitor's profession as one in which every applicant of whatever standing may be trusted to the ends of the earth. Don't laugh, that's not nice. To maintain this reputation and sustain public confidence in the integrity of the profession, it is often necessary that those guilty of serious lapses are not only expelled, but denied readmission. The profession's most valuable asset is its collective reputation and the confidence which that inspires. That's the argument. To which I add, number 28, going back to the Snyder case, the fact that lawyers have special powers. Right? As an officer of the court, a member of the bar enjoys singular powers that others do not possess. By virtue of admission, members of the bar share a kind of monopoly granted only to lawyers. Admission creates a license not only to advise and counsel clients, but also to appear in court and try cases. As an officer of the court, a lawyer can cause persons to drop their private affairs and be called as witnesses in court. And for depositions and other pretrial processes that, while subject to the ultimate control of the court, may be conducted outside courtrooms. The license granted by the the court requires members of the bar to conduct themselves in a manner compatible with the role of courts in the administration of justice. In other words, with great power comes great responsibility. In the event that you're going to have the powers of a lawyer, you also have to conduct yourself in a way that says that we trust you to carry out those powers. That's the law society's justification for policing personal misconduct. The honor of the profession, making sure that people trust the profession, as well as the understanding that you have these powers, you have to use them, we have to trust that you'll use them wisely. The reason why I stress this is because what we're seeing here is that poor character will affect public perception. Jewish law goes in a different direction and says that poor character will affect professional performance. In the event that somebody is of poor character, we have no evidence they've ever done anything wrong in terms of representing a client. Nonetheless, we have a fear that it will affect their ability to do their job in public. Part of there is the concern we already talked about for desecration of God's name via the lawyer's actions. That part exists here as well. I brought you two sources, number 29 and number 30, number 29, which says that wherever there's an element of desecration of God's name, we don't care how great a person is, we remove them from their position. Source number 30 is more directly relevant. Take a look. For a passage out of the Talmud, a young scholar was the subject of bad rumors. There were all sorts of rumors going around about his conduct, enough so that the feeling was, where there's smoke, there's fire. Rabbi Yehuda said, what should we do? Excommunicate him. The sages need him. He's a scholar. Don't excommunicate him. How could you not? That would desecrate the name of God. So he asked Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, the sage, he said, have you heard anything regarding this? Do you know what we should do? He replied, oh yeah, I learned that. Rabbi Yochanan taught it. There's a verse in the prophet Malachi which says, for the lips of the Kohen guard knowledge, and they will seek Torah from his mouth, for he is a Malach of God. Malach means an angel. The Kohen is the teacher of Torah in this passage. He is a Malach, he is an angel of God, on which the Rabbi Yochanan explained, if your mentor seems like a Malach of God, seek Torah from his mouth. If not, don't seek Torah from his mouth. In other words, if there are these rumors about him, get rid of him. He can't be your teacher. It's as simple and straightforward as that. We are not concerned about his honor. We're concerned about about what this person represents. So there is an idea of preserving what in the law society's terms is called the dignity of the profession, the integrity of the profession, the reputation of the profession. However, it goes beyond that. It goes to a practical element. We said that in the event that you have what's called a Rasha de Chamas. Yeah, sorry, oh, the recording stopped? Okay. That's life. The battery added. The other reason for this, the other element of this, goes back to what we said about the Rasha de Chamas, the wicked person who is guilty of taking the property of others. If you take a look at source number 31, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Heller wrote, for a wicked person of Hamas, it should say of, is suspected of that sin. We suspect that he would lie for financial profit. And so we are concerned that he now forges documents and signs them. But a wicked person who has not committed Hamas is disqualified only by fiat of the text. In other words, there are two types of disqualification. A person who is disqualified because he broke random Jewish law is disqualified because the text said wicked person can't be witness. However, when you have somebody who demonstrates greed and that he's willing to break the law due to greed, then we have a separate concern, which is that he's not going to carry out his duties properly because he's going to pursue money instead. And even if you will tell me, says source number 32, that this person may have sinned against God, but not against other people, not talking about a thief, but a person who, let's say, said, you know what? Non-kosher meat would cost me $3. Kosher meat's going to cost me $30. I'm going to buy the non-kosher and save money. You'll say, well, he only sinned against God, not against other human beings. But people who show that they don't respect the law when it's pitted against profit, will find that they also don't respect others when the needs of others are pitted against profit. That's the position of Rabbi Mecklenburg in source number 32. There's a concern that this person is actually not going to practice properly professionally because of greed. And you see it not only in terms of the person who stole, but also in terms of the person who exhibited personal misconduct. He's not involved in settling the world. Why is it that settling the world is such a big deal? Why am I going to disqualify somebody because that person is not engaged in settling the world? Take a look at the comment of Rashi in source number 33. Since they are not involved in settling the world, they're not expert in financial law and commerce, and they don't fear sin. He takes it on a very basic level. A gambler doesn't know the ins and outs of business, doesn't understand what the rules are, because he's not engaged in it. However, that's one take. Others take it more strongly and say, it's because this person is guilty of theft, we therefore can't trust them when it comes to giving testimony, or certainly judging a case that involves an interaction between two parties, two litigants, one suing the other. That's the concern. So what you see here is, and let me make sure that I'm being clear, I'm rushing a little bit, but I want to make sure that this comes across clearly. The disqualification for personal misconduct in the secular system is about undermining trust in the profession. In the Jewish system, it's about undermining trust in the profession, as well as a sense that a person with these character flaws is also not going to function well in the Jewish court as a witness. The reason I stress this is because there is a big difference in the realm of retroactive disqualification. Let's say you had a lawyer who has been practicing law since 2000. 2016, they do something that exhibits personal misconduct. They get a bunch of DUIs or whatever it is. Personal misconduct. Are you now going to say that everything they did since 2000 is disqualified? No. That's the short answer. No. Let's say the following. Let's say they were guilty of the DUIs in 2015. They practiced law after that. It only caught up to them in 2017. Are you going to disqualify them retroactive to 2015? Throw out their work in that interim period? The answer is no, you will not. Because the fundamental concern is about trust in the legal system, and that's only an issue going forward. At the moment when it's discovered, does that person become disqualified? But in the Jewish system, it doesn't work that way because the concern is that misconduct undermines their ability to function. So if you take a look, hang on just 1 second. If you take a look quickly at number 34, the Maimonides writes, like thieves and bandits, even if they return the money, they may not testify from the time they steal or take by force. And passage 30 in number 35, they are in fact disqualified retroactively. In this case, it's talking about somebody who actually lied under oath. From the time he testified, he became wicked, but it's not just someone who lied under oath, it's in general. We disqualify them retroactive to the time of to the time of whatever they did that earned them the disqualification. Yes?
You know what? I was thinking about the fact that they could have been incompetent in their work. So if they were drunk in 2015, you'd want to look at whatever work they did.
Correct.
It's a little different.
Right. But that's absolutely true. In other words, you may well re-examine what they did in the last 2 years and say, you know, is there any evidence that we should reopen those cases? Did they represent their clients properly? Were they intoxicated at the time? Whatever it was. That's absolutely true. But there's no automatic disqualification where in Jewish law there actually is. Yeah?
This actually happened with the coroner in Ontario.
Yeah.
That they went back.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, because it was evidence.
See, that's the thing, and this is one of the reasons why there's a distinction. We're comparing apples and oranges, and I stressed it in the beginning, but I have to come back to it now. We're comparing witnesses with lawyers, but there's a major difference. Right? When it comes to the personal misconduct for the lawyer, you could argue that the fact that he doesn't have so much respect for the law does not necessarily translate as directly to him violating his terms of practice compared to a witness in court who, if we know this person has a love of money and is willing to break the law for money, is eminently bribable. So the argument could be made that the systems would come more in line with each other if we were dealing with issues that are more in line overall. There's more to say on that, but what we see here so far, before we get to our last piece, is that both systems police personal conduct, but the focus in the law society is police personal conduct, but the focus of the law society is the reputation of the legal system and the powers of a lawyer, which lead to greater responsibility, whereas in Jewish law, it's much more about bad character influencing personal conduct, although there is still the issue of the reputation of the legal system. Last bit, the issue of regaining acceptance in each system. So both systems have a way for you to come back and be able to practice again. In source number 36, I gave you one source which is quoted in many different places. The case of, I think it's George Stephen Wiseman. They're talking about how to readmit. So there are actually 7 criteria in the case. 2 of them are not relevant for our discussion. That's why I didn't bring them here. One of them is that he has to remain current in the law. That's very interesting, but it's not germane to the issue of correcting wrongs. The 5 here are: the applicant must show by a sufficient course of conduct he is a person to be trusted. The applicant must show that his conduct is unimpeached and unimpeachable, meaning current conduct, which can best be established by evidence of trustworthy persons, especially persons with whom the applicant has been associated since the disqualification. A sufficient period of time must have elapsed before an application for readmission will be granted. So you have to show that he's a person to be trusted. Current actions are unquestionable, unimpeachable. Time passes. The applicant must show that it is highly unlikely that the applicant will misconduct himself in future. I didn't even know misconduct could be a verb. Will misconduct himself in future. And the applicant must show that his or her past conduct has been entirely purged, admitting guilt and righting the wrongs. Those are your requirements that are quoted in case after case of somebody seeking to be readmitted. There's another set of requirements in Blackburn, which also gets quoted in various places in source number 37. There are some variations. They want nature and duration. I'm sorry, panel should consider the nature and duration of the misconduct, meaning just how bad was it, whether the applicant is remorseful, were there rehabilitative efforts, how has the conduct been, and again, the passage of time. And then there's one more, which I brought you in number 38, from the case of Sarah Jane Jackson, the one who had given the drugs to EC. There's also, they mention the need for deterrence in there. We talked about deterrence a little bit in one of the previous sources. You want there to be a deterrent to future activity, and that's part of why we require the passage of time. So that's the secular system. It seems to be a relatively complex type of an analysis, in the sense that whoever is the panel that's hearing the application for readmission is going to have to figure out how much time has elapsed and is that appropriate. Do we have a pattern of good behavior? Do we have good witnesses who can testify to that good behavior? Is there remorse? But that's the nature of it. It is a difficult thing to analyze when you're dealing with, particularly when you're dealing with personal misconduct. The Jewish system is actually very similar, although it's phrased more simply. Source number 39. A butcher was found to have sold non-kosher meat. Rav Nachman disqualified him and removed him. He said, you can't serve as a butcher anymore. We can't trust you. He grew his beard and nails, meaning that he displayed grief. He doesn't cut his hair. He lets his nails grow. Rav Nachman said, oh, I'd like to approve him. Rava, another sage, said to him, he could be playing a trick. How in the world can you trust him just because he showed that, you know, he's got bad grooming? That doesn't really qualify. Ditto for fasting, ditto for giving charity. That doesn't work. So how should he be fixed? As Rav Evi Bar Oven said, one who is suspected of non-kosher meat cannot be fixed until he goes to a place where he is not known. That's key. And he returns valuable lost property, or he disposes of valuable non-kosher meat at his own expense. In other words, the sin that he committed was a sin of taking advantage of others, breaking Jewish law, for financial gain. So what we need is for him to show that he's gotten over his greed.
How does that work? He has to go to a place where no one knows him. And the idea of no one knowing him is that therefore he can't just be doing this for show because people aren't even aware of his history. And while there, he has to show behavior which demonstrates that he's willing to forego his own financial well-being in the name of honesty. So if he, over there slaughters meat and it's non-kosher, he gets rid of it. He doesn't try to sell it. He finds somebody's property that was lost, he returns it. That's the standard expanded on by Maimonides in source number 40, when he says, if somebody violates an oath, how is it that he can become acceptable afterwards? If he goes before a court that doesn't know him, and he admits that he's under suspicion. So he's called into court and he says, I can't swear because I've been convicted elsewhere. He acknowledges it. Or he becomes obligated in an oath in a court that doesn't know him for a valuable sum, and he pays rather than swear. He says, you know what? I have litigation against somebody else. The court would trust me. And instead of swearing, I'm just going to pay up. He has to do something that demonstrates that he's not going to act in the name of his greed. So you can see parallels between this and the secular system. The secular system is more sophisticated in it in terms of listing requirements and saying the period of time involved. We require character witnesses. But fundamentally, we're operating on the same principle, which is to say we want this person to be able to come back. We don't want this person to be out of the field more than is necessary. And what we require is that they've corrected the wrong that is in them. So to summarize everything that we've said in approximately 30 seconds, both systems will disqualify for professional misconduct. Both systems would prefer not to disqualify for personal misconduct due to issues like the right to practice in the secular system, the issue of the honor of the legal professional within the Jewish system, common to both, the issues of privacy, the issues of access to justice, and making sure that we have lawyers. Both systems do enforce personal misconduct, although with a different emphasis. The secular system because of public trust, the Jewish system because of both public trust and a sense that personal misconduct bleeds into professional practice, and that leads into the distinction regarding retroactive disqualification, where the Jewish system will have it and the secular apparently will not, meaning an automatic disqualification. Finally, both have the possibility of readmission, but Jewish law requires demonstration of reform, and the secular system has a more elaborate set of rules that you'd have to satisfy in order to be readmitted. Thank you very much. Once again, if you did not sign in, please make sure that you do so.